As I mentioned last week, we're going to continue talking about the excavations that are taking place at Kirbit Kiafa. And they began in 2007, and they're continuing. Now, Wally gave a presentation on the work that was done up until 2009, some time last year, and so I'm just continuing some of the work that Wally has started. Hopefully there's some new things. I'll probably be repeating some things that you remember from before. But remember, repetition is the way we learn. It's the way we remember. So, here's a fabulous aerial shot. I can see it on the screen here very well. I don't know how well it shows up for you out there. But compared to the picture he showed, a lot more work has been done in this area here. And there's a gate area, which is right here, which we will talk about. There's also a gate up here. And so here's a town that had two gates in operation at the same town. And that's significant in helping identify, maybe in the Bible, the name of this particular city, town, whatever you want to call it. Here's its location on the map showing Israel. It's located in a valley. Here's the river heading out towards the Mediterranean Sea. This particular valley is the place where we said David and Goliath met. And these towns are mentioned in the scriptures. And so therefore, this could be possibly Shaharim. That could be the name of this town. And it's on the northern side of the river. And remember, we showed that the Philistines were on the southern side of the valley and the Israelites were on the northern side of the valley. Here's just another map showing the same places a little more close up. This is the area that was occupied by the Philistines. And so you have Gath, which we know is a Philistine community. And somewhere over here is where this village is that they're excavating. And so it looks like it's probably in Judah. Okay, and of course that's one of the questions that's being asked. And the Philistine camp was over here and the Israeli camp was over here. And it says when they defeated them, the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shaharim as far as Gath and Ekron. Well, this particular excavation has moved to the front lines in the debate over Bible accuracy. And I'll explain what I mean by that as we get further into our discussion tonight. Why is this, you know, so important with regard to Bible accuracy? And the answer is, well, there's been a long-running archaeological problem with King David. The problem is, there's no evidence, archaeological evidence, that David ever existed. At least that's the way it's been for a long time. And so we have the Bible saying that he existed. There's a lot said about David in the Bible, but prove it. Show me something that I can dig up that says David is here. A lot of the other things that are in the Bible have been found. That are found in the Old Testament. Cities have been uncovered that are there. So, problem. All right. Well, we certainly know something about the Egyptians, right? We know that they were a powerful country. Well, how do we know that? Well, we see these big, funny-looking things sticking up in the sky. Huge monuments, okay? The pyramids. Who made them? Some farmers? I don't think so. Probably some pretty sharp people, engineers, constructions, you know, they had cranes and bulldozers and heavy equipment. We were just talking about Hoover Dam, putting that together and building the new bridge over it. That doesn't just happen, you know. It takes a lot of engineering and a lot of money and a lot of equipment to make that happen. So somebody of a great civilization built these things. We find tombs. King Tut's coffin. There's 2,500 pounds of gold. Right. Sounds like wealth. But there's nothing like this regarding the great empire that David had. And so, It's a good question. Is it real? How about the Colosseum built by the Romans? How'd that get built? Did some farmers come and everybody bring a stone and let's pile them up and we'll build the Colosseum? Or did it take some thinking? I mean, the Romans get credit for building something called the arch. Okay, and with the arch design, it was now possible to build stadiums. To build, you know, before when they had a theater or a stadium, they'd have to go to a hillside. And then they put seats on the hillside, and the speaker would stand here, speak to the people in the audience. But now you could build something on a flatland that would have seats going up because you knew how to build these kind of structures. Had to have architects and engineers and equipment, masons. So it took years to build this. It meant there was some kind of organization, some sort of society, some sort of government that organized it. All right. And what examples of wealth and power did David's kingdom leave behind? Haven't found it yet. It's a problem. It's not around. We keep digging, we don't find it. Well, let's see if we can find out why this might be true. We haven't found anything from David's time that shows that he had money, resources, and people being focused into large projects. And there's been no evidence of a central government or administration in Israel from the 10th century B.C., David's time frame. Let's look, though, at maybe some explanations as why this kind of evidence is not readily, available about David's time. We need to talk about what was Israel before David's time. In Judges, we read, Judges 18:1, it says, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. There was no overarching leadership. People did what they felt they needed to do. Sort of like this country when it got started. We had towns. We had small little villages. And there were different kinds of skills in the little villages, but we didn't have any great industrial revolution kind of facility here until later on in time. So that's the way they were. You know, they had lived in Egypt, and then they came out. They sort of took over what was here, and they were shepherds and farmers, finally, but they didn't really have any central ruling. And sporadically, when they'd get in trouble, you know, somebody would be raised up to get them out of trouble, to lead them, and we called them judges. But it was just a regional chieftain. Sometimes the tribes actually fought amongst themselves. So, you know, if you're fighting amongst yourselves, you're not going to become organized to get anything accomplished. And Saul was the first king. Okay, so 40 years before David, there was a king in Israel. But how did he do? Well, he didn't really seem to establish a very strong central government. When they were in battle, sometimes they'd melt away and run and flee. Certainly the David and Goliath story is exactly, that's what we were seeing there. And he certainly had trouble enforcing what he wanted the people to do. So he didn't necessarily bring Israel together as a strong, powerful nation. So we conclude there was no evidence of a centralized planning with administrators who could manage national projects. So we're talking about, you know, when you build these big monuments that take 10 years to build or something like that, you got to get the people organized and make it happen. Israel was essentially a farming tribal system, and these slides that I'm showing you are, as I mentioned before, were given to me by Luke Chandler, who has been at the two of the last digs at this site. And so he said it's like rural Afghanistan, okay, in the news. So that's if you want to kind of see what kind of things were like in Israel in these early days, that's kind of what was going on. And so you really didn't have engineering and architectural knowledge in Israel before the time of David. You didn't have colleges where people would go, or training grounds or whatever, where you could take on a big, huge building program. And so these kind of things take time to evolve before you have a country that can do these kinds of things. And there's another good reason why we haven't found much from David's time. Think about that. The answer is, a lot of the sites are currently Islamic holy sites or in resistive Arab neighborhoods. They're off limits for doing archaeological work. In fact, there's a lot of conflict that goes on where sometimes Israelis are really into archaeology, and they'll dig underground and they'll just be going into the Palestinian regions and be finding stuff down below, and of course that's Arab territory above them. And when they find out, they say, "Hold it! What are you doing? That's our country you're under." And so World War III might start. So the Bible says, let's look at some of the things the Bible says and let's see what archaeology says, okay? Well, the Bible says there was no effective government in Israel before David's time. So that's a starting point. Before the 10th century. There were clans and local chieftains, judges. The Bible says there were just small cities. There were no large-scale buildings. Don't forget, the temple's not built yet. The temple gets built, Solomon. Not David, not Saul, Solomon. Okay. Now, David unites all the tribes into a state ruled from Jerusalem. So now they have a headquarters. You know, Saul wasn't ruling from Jerusalem. Forget where he was. He was somewhere in Ephraim. Ramah, something like that. That's my memory. Could be wrong. So, construction of large buildings and strong fortified cities. He did get involved in construction of large public buildings and strong fortified cities. David did do that. Just haven't found them yet. He did have a central administration. And he wrote literature. The Psalms. This is an indication of a central, organized. He was the king, had a kingdom, he had a palace, he had a home, things like that. What does archaeology tell us? Doesn't see anything. No effective government during David's time. No large buildings or monumental architecture. Haven't found anything like that. Now I have to mention that there is a woman, her name is Eliat Mazar, who is excavating in the city of David, and she claims to have found walls, large walls, for the city of David. In fact, I think she even has claimed that she's found some of the palace walls. Okay, now, she isn't being necessarily accepted that this is that she hasn't validated from her fellow archaeologists that they believe that she's found this. But certainly she continues to do work in the City of David area, and I think with time she will be vindicated that she has indeed found David's palace. But right now, there's no acceptance that anything like this exists. No signs of a centralized administration. No inscriptions or other written materials that show literacy or record keeping. You know, where are the clay tablets with all this information, etc.? All we have is the scriptures. There's scriptures. That's certainly written stuff. But if it was written in 500 BC, then it was written after all the things that it's talking about. So they're looking for some external evidence that supports what's being written in the Bible. Haven't found any yet. There's no evidence of a national government or for at least another century. I mean, eventually, there is stuff found. But it's dated 100 years later. So we're talking about David's time now. There's little evidence of literary among the Israelite tribes. Okay, so that's the problem. Where are the monuments of David's centralized powerful kingdom? Well, the archaeologists have an explanation for why he can't find it. And it's been through at least two phases. I think we're entering into phase three. Phase one. There was no central kingdom in Israel during the 10th century, during David and Solomon's time. That's a statement. No evidence. Therefore, there wasn't one. They are mythical people. David and Solomon never really existed. They're stories that got written down. They never really existed. This is phase one now of archaeologists. And this was a popular belief not too long ago. Now, you know, we don't know that because we're not in that field. But that's where the, you know, the universities that are teaching and raising up archaeologists of this time period, this is what the conclusions were. And, you know, if you're just give me the facts and you throw the Bible out, can't count that. This is the conclusion you would come to. Phase one conclusion. And this was the popular belief until there was something written on stone found in Tell, in a Tell, which is a mound, covered up city, in Dan. Everybody remember where Dan is? Way up north, north of the Sea of Galilee. And they were excavating there, and in 1993 they found a piece of something. So this was part of a bigger thing, a stela or something, and it's broken up, but they got a couple of pieces, and when they look at it and they read what's being written there, it says something about the house of David. It mentions the house of David. So here's some external evidence that says there was a house of David. So they look at this and they say, ooh, maybe David is real. Okay? So we've got to now face the fact that now we've got some external evidence that there was a King David, or some kind of a house of David, the king that David was over. And so this gentleman, whose name I brought up before, Professor Israel Finkelstein, he wrote a book about the Bible unearthed. And he offered an explanation for the lack of evidence for David's kingdom. And he's at the Tel Aviv University. And the book he wrote, The Bible Unearthed, it's Archaeology's New Vision of Ancient Israel and the Origin of its Sacred Text. And the book came out in 2001. He is the director of the Institute of Archaeology at Tel Aviv. And so he had a lot of persuasive power over what the archaeologists of the Middle East were thinking during this time period. And just this is a picture that Luke gave us of showing him here at this site. So he brought his students with him because they got to take a look at this, because they have to explain, well, what is this? Wait a minute. This looks like maybe there's some evidence that David was a king of a powerful kingdom and built this fortress out here that took about 10 years to build. And you just don't build this, and we'll get into that. You just don't build this fortress with some shepherds and some farmers. Okay, so he's out there looking at it, and he's interested. So here's the explanation, though, that he gave, and this is phase two. Okay, basically, he said, well, I guess David and Solomon are real people. But they were just like the judges. They were just local heads, local chieftains, and they were located in the southern hills of Israel. So, not a king of the whole nation of Israel, all these tribes, all united with organization and able to do great things. No, he's just a local head guy. Therefore, their wealth and power is a little more than a few sheep, a few goats, and they couldn't exert a strong influence beyond the hills around Jerusalem. So they didn't reach out any further than the locale of Jerusalem. And there's no indication, there's no evidence of any central powerful kingdom during this time period. They haven't dug anything up yet that would have given them that evidence. And so this theory has not been seriously questioned by most scholars, again, based on evidence, until our subject, Kerbet Kiapa. Because now they definitely have a site which demonstrates organization, the ability to design something and bring together people, and it's in the right time frame. This is dated in David's time. Not somebody built this later on. This is David's time. And so we're going to look at some of the evidence that makes you come to that conclusion. Okay? The history of this site. One thing that's neat about it is it's only been inhabited twice in ancient times. Now, that didn't really strike me until I started thinking about, in our country, have any of you been to Williamsburg, Virginia? Anybody went to Williamsburg? I got some heads nodding. Yeah, good, good. And what's neat about Williamsburg is it was pretty easy to rebuild because nobody went in there and tore it apart and built another city on top of it or farmed it or anything. So when they went in there and started scratching around, they could find foundations of houses and roads and things like that and restore it to the way it was. Because when something got built somewhere, it got built somewhere else. So Colonial Williamsburg was lived in at one time and then kind of just went into abandonment. And so when they went in there, it didn't take much to find what was originally there because people didn't come in and start picking up stones and start picking up beams and moving roads around and everything. So they knew exactly where everything was, and they've restored it to Colonial Williamsburg, which you can go visit today and feel pretty comfortable that when you're walking down this road, that's the way it was. All right. It's not like we have a place here called Sturbridge Village. That's kind of remanufactured. They sort of brought stuff from all over and created a typical village of that time. Okay, only inhabited twice. Now, they didn't have bulldozers. So what they did was they just filled in. They would fill in and then build on top of. That's why all these excavation sites are usually a big mound or a tell. And as they go down through the layers, they get older and older and older stuff as they go down. And some of the material gets moved around. So some of the old stuff gets moved up to be used in the new site. But that's important. Only twice. It was a heavily fortified hilltop fortress on a hill. You're going to be in a battle. You want to be on top. You want to be in the valley. You want to be up on top. And there was a period of time that it existed between 1980 BC. This was David's time. And the other time was, and then it was abandoned for about 700 years, and then it became a fortified city in the 3rd century BC. This is, you know, around 200, 300 BC. And this was during the Greek, you remember the Greek Empire? And so it was during that time. So, and it only existed in that form for 20 or 30 years, and then was left alone. So you basically got, when you look at this place and you go digging around, you'll find two different types of fortification being built there. Easy to identify. This is a picture of a Hellenistic or Greek threshold. And I assume this is the threshold as you enter into the village. And it's built on top of the threshold, which was below it, which was the threshold of entering the city when it was built during David's time. So they had to move this out of the way to find out what was underneath it. A lot of pottery found when they dig through the rubble and everything. And they get pieces of pottery, they get whole pieces of things. And by looking at the pottery, they can say, well, this is pottery that's representative of a certain time frame. And people made pottery, certain styles, certain materials. And the pottery fits into that time period. It's Iron Age pottery. And it's dated to David's time. And so that means that people were there. They were there for a particular period of time. And then it was abandoned. So you don't have this gradation of pottery over hundreds of years, the way it changes. You find just one kind of pottery, and then it's gone. All right. Olive pits. That's something you can carbon date. They found a few. Hard to see, but there's one, there's one, there's one, there's one, and there's one. They'll probably find more with time. And carbon dating is useful for establishing dates that are within 5,000-6,000 years. Maybe some people claim you can go 10, maybe 20,000 years with carbon dating. Okay, but certainly, we're talking about 1,000 BC, 3,000 years ago. Certainly well within the ability of carbon dating. And it puts the date of these pits in that time frame. So you got another thing that says, okay, the people who ate these pits were here during this time frame, David's period. Okay? And, all right. This is pretty exciting. They found a piece of pottery with writing on it. This wasn't scratched into the pottery. If it was, maybe it would be easier to read. It was written with ink. And if you go to the website for the dig, their website, there's a lot of work going on with this piece of pottery, trying to use various modern day technologies to see if they can really read these symbols that are on here, because the ink is kind of, it's been washed away. So they use infrared cameras, they use different filters, I think they're even, using radiation and all kinds of stuff. They're sending it. It's been in Massachusetts. Some of the laboratories here have done work on it and everything. Because it's not something that can be, this is one rendition of what somebody thinks was there. In other words, if you go back, you look at that and you say, some of these regions, you guys can't see anything. Some of these regions doesn't look like there's anything there, and yet if I go to this picture, they ended up putting some stuff down there. Well, this doesn't look like Hebrew writing to me. But it is proto-Arabic, whatever, Semitic, fits into that time frame. And this, they say, is the oldest writing that has been discovered. So it's very fascinating. Now, some people are saying this is old, ancient Hebrew script, but that's still being debated really heavily. So you'll see those words being used here, but I think the people who were prejudiced who found it and said, Hebrew writing proves it. And of course, there are some people who are saying, you're jumping to conclusions. But it says, this is the oldest Hebrew inscription yet discovered. So that's pretty exciting when they found this. So this evidence supports the existence of a strong government in David's time. Why? Because here, if you look at how many houses were there, you could only have a few hundred people living there. All right? And yet there's over 200,000 tons of stone in its fortification. Now, remember, if all you had were shepherds and farmers, how are they going to bring 200 tons of stone and bring it in this fortification? Why would they do that to support a few hundred people that live there? Does that make any sense? No, it doesn't make sense. And so this indicates that, it's double the weight of two combat-loaded aircraft carriers. I'll trust Luke knows what he's talking about. This is a picture that he took, and what he wants to show you here is there's a stone that's as big as he is. And so it's not like, you look over here and you say, we live in New England. You can see walls all over the place made of stones like this, but once in a while we see some pretty big ones. But rarely, I think, do we see things of this size, except out there. And that was moved by a D8 tractor. And I got one in my backyard that was moved by a D8 Caterpillar front end loader, And so you just don't get a couple guys and let's pick this thing up and build a wall with it. So again, some technology, and these things had to come from somewhere. And there's a lot of these apparently in this wall. So this is indication of organized, designed people getting a job done over a 10-year period of time. 10 years, estimated. And so it's way out of proportion for way out in the village, way out there. Why would they do that? And this is evidence then that supports the fact that there was a strong central authority that says, we got to protect our border out there from the Philistines. And we're going to build a fortress out there on this hillside, because this is the road that leads from, I think, Ekron to Jerusalem. And we got to stop them. Jerusalem is where our king lives. We got to stop them way out here. And this is where the battle took place between the Philistines and the Israelites before David was king. He's just a little boy, a little shepherd boy with a slingshot, with a sling. Okay, so it was designed and built by one strong power to defend against another, and the site is on the border of the Philistine and Israelites. The Philistines and the Israelites. Okay, so now we're into phase three. What are the scholars going to say about this? And again, we're at the embryonic stage of this excavation. You know, after 20 years, then we'll see if we, then we'll see what the conclusions are. But right now, they have to respond to it. And the answer is, well, it's built by the Philistines. It's not built by the Israelites. You're mistaken. Yes, they were powerful, and they built it to protect their border, not for Israel to protect their border. Maybe that's the answer. Well, let's see if it holds up. How would you argue against that? They had a central government. They could build it, and so it must have been them. Is there anything at the site which appears to be Philistine? Well, there's no Philistine pottery. The architecture or the inscriptions, or architecture or inscriptions, have been found. So there isn't any evidence that said, well, we know this is a Philistine site. And Philistine sites have been excavated, and so they know what to expect if they're in Philistine country. Here's the evidence that says it's definitely a city of Judah or an Israeli. First of all, now I say this is still being questioned, but that inscription they say is Hebrew. They know it's definitely not Philistine. So they say it's Hebrew. There are other cities that we know are Israel constructed cities, like Hazor and Megiddo and Beersheba, and they have a particular architecture. And this city is designed like those other Iron Age cities in Israel. And I'll show you some of those features that we're talking about. This is a four-chamber gate with casement city walls. I know what a four-chamber gate is, but I had no idea what a casement wall was. But Google and Yahoo educate me all the time. And so, let me see if I can help you here. This is the entrance to the city. And as you see here, there are these four walled-in areas. This is looking down. You're above it, and you're looking down on the city walls. Okay. And what this is, and of course, we've been to Hazor, which was built by, I think, Solomon. And they actually have six. This has four compartments. They have six. And this is where you would have your military people waiting. So anybody trying to come in, they're going to face these guys. Then they get past them, there's going to be another group of soldiers that will stop them. So this is the way you protected your city gate from the divide. And like I say, some of the later cities that were built had actually six areas where soldiers and battle people were ready. So that's a four-chamber gate. Four chambers. One, two, three, four. Casement city walls. A casement city wall is, here's the external part of the wall. Here's the internal part of the wall. It's like a double wall. Okay? Well, if you want to build a thick wall, you need a lot of material. It takes you a long time to do it. But if you build two thin walls, and the time comes when all of a sudden somebody's going to attack you, you could just fill in the space in between the two, and then have your big, strong, wide, thick wall. But in the meantime, you can use this... What happened here? In the meantime, you can use this space to store stuff, and so you're not wasting all that space with this big honking wall. So that's a casement wall. So that's one of them. That was shown on the picture. And this is the other one. Remember, this is a city of two gates that were in use at the same time. And it shows here, you're trying to show here, it has a gate, four compartments there, and then your casement walls as well. This was typical of the kinds of city protections that was built in Israel during this time frame. And the houses were connected to the city walls. So here's the city wall, and then these are the rooms of the houses that people lived in on the other side of it. So they used the wall as part of their living space. As opposed to, we'll have a wall and then we'll build a bunch of houses internally. There were houses internally, but there were houses also along the wall as well. This was typical of the way villages and cities were constructed during this time frame by Israelites. And this is just a picture of Luke sitting in an entrance that he worked on that is an entrance to the casement. The casement wall is behind him, and here's the two walls, and this was an entrance that would allow you to use that space in there as well, which he excavated. And this is in Beersheba. This is an artist's view, but I assume that the dark areas are real walls that they've excavated, and the rest of this is either what they know is there by using special kind of techniques to lay things out, or it's just, you know, an idea with your roads and your houses and the wall around the city. But the thing it's trying to show here is a four-chamber gate here that's being shown. And here's the road that brings people in. And that's all it's just is trying to show these things. Two other Judite sites have this same design. All right. Let's keep going. So this kind of validates that there was some kind of centralized design that was being used during this period of time for designing cities in Israel. And so the wall gate design is not found in any Canaanite or Philistine city. It is in cities of the northern kingdom of Israel. And I mentioned Hazor and Megiddo have these kind of designs in their walls and in their entryways. We've got the ancient Hebrew inscription, we've got the case wall, the gate designs, and the pottery. Okay, so these are all things. The pottery is pottery of the type found in early Judean cities, and later on there was apparently pottery that had an inscription on them. I put the pointer on the screen here instead of up here. Here's an inscription. And these have the letters LMLK, and it means it belongs to the king. And so Hezekiah had immense riches and honor, and he made for himself treasuries and storehouses for the produce of grain, wine, and oil. And so this pottery had a stamp on him, something for the king. But the pottery that's been found in Kirbet Kiapha doesn't have any of this, so it moves it back in time. It's not in Hezekiah's time, it's earlier. Another argument. Hundreds of animal bones. I think this is strong. I think this is strong evidence supporting this is a Judean city and not a Philistine city. Hundreds of animal bones have been discovered to date. So far, none are pig bones. Why is that? Well, pigs were unclean, according to the law of Moses. But pig bones are common at Philistine and Canaanite sites, but not Israelite sites. So I think, you know, maybe you don't buy the ancient Hebrew inscription. Maybe you say, well, we just haven't found enough casement wall and gate designs in other cities yet. Maybe the pottery's older than younger and things like that. But I think this, at least for me, nails down the fact that this is a city that was built by the Judeans and not the Philistines. And then this kind of just talks about the fact that here's the centralized government and the pottery that they found. Pretty neat stuff. How about writing? Again, certainly the Bible shows that we got Psalms and all kinds of religious documents during the time of David. And here's what they've done. They found now at least some evidence that at that time people were writing things down. Although they weren't writing on parchment, but parchment's not going to hold up. It's going to be gone. It dissolves. But a piece of pottery like this with some writing on it, and like I say, there's a lot of work going on to analyze this, and over the next year or two, we'll probably have a pretty good consensus of who wrote it and what it says. I mean, there are translations of what it says, but I think it's too soon to basically put it forth as real evidence. Let me just also say that I would like to preface that all of this is fresh information. Okay, I used to do R&D, and I begin it, going to give a presentation the next day, and somebody would rush in to me and say, "I did an experiment and I found this results, and you know, maybe you want to include it in your presentation tomorrow." And I used to say, "Well, I have a 24-hour rule. And I don't present anything that I haven't at least thought about or sat on or something for at least 24 hours. And the reason I said that was because very often, you know, somebody comes in with something that's very excited about, some new information, et cetera, et cetera. And then the day later they come in and they say, "Oh, throw that data out. You know, I made a mistake, or, you know, my gauge wasn't calibrated." And so here I am presenting it to people as evidence, and it's garbage. And so I think in this field, you wait even longer. You wait years, okay? And so I'm saying it, maybe it's this place, and I'm saying maybe this is a piece of Hebrew writing, but it could be wrong. It could be proven to be something else. And the danger we have is when we stand up here and present information to Christians, and then they go out and they tell non-Christians, and then it turns out to be false. You know, we like to use that for the evolutionists, you know, this is the latest, greatest find, and this is, you know, this proves that evolution is true, and then a few years later they go, "Oh, no, that's wrong." So we like to use it against them, but they can do the same thing. So keep in mind, this is fresh. The ink is still wet, and I still have my eraser out. Okay. But anyway, we do have now some strong evidence that there was a centralized, powerful monarchy in Judah during David's time, and so we're beginning to have some now external evidence that during David's reign there was a powerful government. And why is this important? Well, this is just a picture of a stable that they found there, and there's the manger, they found an intact shrine there, and I kind of look at this and I say, "Whoa, wait a minute, what is this?" An idol shrine. And when you look at it this way, it looked like it was just a jar, but when they actually tipped it over, it had a hole in it, and then they found a little figurine next to it, which was about the size of a little finger. They didn't get a picture of it before it got whisked away and put it in the bag. But idol worship. But we know the Bible supports that. These people were idolaters. And so there was a little shrine here at this site, and there's evidence that they found it. In about a couple months, if these dates are held, there's going to be a NOVA episode about this site. They've been there now for the last 2 years, taking pictures and interviewing the folks that are doing it. So we want to make sure, and I'll let people know when this thing is, when we know when it is. I'm sure Luke will put it on his website or his blog. It's all supposed to be written up in a National Geographic magazine too. So it'll be interesting to see what spin they put on it when we read these articles, because definitely NOVA and National Geographic are not supporters of the Bible. So it would be interesting to see what's said there. And the BBC was there with their cameras, and they plan to produce a documentary on King David, and it's going to be released in the January-February time frame. But I'm sure that, you know, with the internet and everything, whatever they produce, we'll eventually be able to view it. So I'll be looking forward to that as well. And so that's kind of where we're at right now. I think it's an exciting site. It's kind of neat that we have a preacher that we know, and we get up-to-date information. That I mentioned last week that there's going to be a big conference in a couple of weeks, where a lot of this data is going to be presented to peers. And so, a lot of stuff gets kicked around then. And of course, next year, they'll be back excavating again. And so we're at the beginning of maybe something that's going to be really profound in supporting David and his kingdom. And it's important, really, to Christians for several reasons. One, we know that the Messiah, we're based on the fact that is going to be in the lineage of David. And if David didn't exist, it's sort of like Paul when he said, if Christ wasn't risen, we're most miserable. I mean, let's face it, our whole basis for belief in being a Christian is that Jesus existed, he was real, and he was resurrected. I mean, a lot of people say, yeah, there was Jesus walking around, and yeah, he was a great guy, and he's a good teacher, and all that kind of stuff, neat guy, but resurrected? No way. No, we believe in the resurrection. And we believe that Jesus is a descendant of King David. And the messianic promises are being fulfilled through Jesus. So it's very important that we be able to, not only based on our reading of the Bible, but also it's good that we will be able to at some point in time maybe even say that there's plenty of external evidence that supports this as well. I'm not going to show any more. It's 6 o'clock. You've been very patient with me. I eat, sleep, and breathe this kind of stuff, so I like sharing it with you. And if you have any questions or anything, the best source is Luke Chandler's blog. And he keeps adding to it about this. He grabs a little piece of what he discovered, and then he writes it up. And so it's coming. He just wrote about that pottery thing that site a couple days ago. So it's really neat stuff. Well, thank you for your time and patience. I realize this lecture, this presentation, is not a lesson that tells you how to become a Christian. And you've heard many lessons. In fact, we had a fine lesson this morning on baptism, which is the final step in that we do to have our sins washed away. It's not getting wet. Whenever I go out and grab people and plunge them in water, underwater, and drown them, they're just going to get wet. But it's an appeal to God for a good conscience. And so you have to believe, you have to be willing to change, you have to be willing to confess and be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins. So if there's any here tonight who'd like to take advantage of God's plan of salvation, there's an opportunity now to do it. You don't have to do it now. You want to do it half an hour from now? You want to do it an hour from now? We've had people call us up 2 or 3 hours later, come down to the building, and immerse them into Christ for the forgiveness of sin. Whatever your interest is, we can help you in any way. Please come forward as we stand and sing the song that Eric has selected.